And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. So recently, we've been talking on the show about lobbying in the Massachusetts State House. Right? Lobbying is a nice word for pressuring the legislature to pass certain bills, right? To have certain legislative outcomes. And we have the good fortune to bump into some guys from Brown University who have done a study, an interesting study that actually looks at real honest-to-God data, right? So we're not bouncing opinions around here. We've got underlying data that supports basically a dissection of the way lobbying is done on Beacon Hill and allows us to look at who the players are, what they do, and knowledge is power. So it's good for climate activists to know the way things work up on Beacon Hill. So I'm happy to have with us Galen Hall. How are you doing, Galen?
Good. How are you, Ted?
Good, good, good. And Trevor Culhane, the co-authors of this report from the Climate and Development Lab. How are you doing, Trevor?
Good. Good to be here.
So did I describe the report that you've generated reasonably accurately, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a report that is about the mechanisms of lobbying on Beacon Hill. In that report, which we will link to on the blog page, there are 12 thoughtful key findings that you guys. I thought we could sort of walk through some of those, okay? And one of the things that just knocked my socks off is that in your analysis, the two big stacks of data that you worked on were testimony, which is the appearance of citizens in front of a committee of the Massachusetts legislature to give their opinion, as compared to reports by lobbyists who are professionals who can approach your elected representatives at almost any time through the legislative process. But you guys found that there's something like a 9-to-1 ratio of climate activists showing up to make testimony in public about why they support a bill as compared to the people who oppose the bill. It's not anywhere near 50-50, right?
Right. Yeah. So testimony is really the one spot, right, when we think about the legislature's two-year cycle where the public's really invited to give input on legislation. When we look at the input that people are giving, right, it's really, really strongly in support of climate action. And in addition, right, the 90% is in support of climate action. In addition to that, all of the people who showed up on their own behalf, almost all of them were showing up in support of climate action. So that that percentage is even greater for individuals who are just there on their own behalf. So really what we're seeing is when the legislators is asking for input on climate legislation, they see really strong support, but we know that the outcomes are not matching that in terms of what is actually moving through the legislature.
And maybe you did not make this kind of comparison in your analysis, but could you say, I mean, I think that if you had a bill on, pick a hot button, right, gun control or abortion, you would have at least 50-50 a split of public commentary. Is that fair? And did you look at any of that kind of data as a comparison, or we just, I mean, I would say, I would make that assertion that you have a public voice on both sides. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of really hot button topics. We didn't make that comparison partially because testimony is not public. Uh-huh. So it took a lot of work. It took about a dozen visits to the State House to get what we got. So we weren't asking for anything that we didn't really need for this study. Right. But I definitely think, right, there's a lot of more contentious issues, particularly in Massachusetts, but climate is really not one of them. There's really broad consensus that we need climate action in this state.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so then the other question is, so now let's flip the perspective. Another one of your findings says that the clean energy advocates, right, the people that are testifying in public, are being outspent, dramatically outspent by the professional lobbying class by a factor of 3.5 to 1. So tell me more about that. What is that? How should people think about that?
Yeah, so the first thing to note, sort of for integrity's sake, is that we don't know how much National Grid pays their lobbyists to lobby on a particular bill. We just know how much they pay them at the end of the year. So, you know, it's hard to say, oh, these fossil fuel companies outspent these environmental advocates by a factor of 3-to-1, 4-to-1, whatever, on this particular issue. But what we can say is we look at who's most engaged on this issue on both sides, and then what are the resources they bring to bear on the legislature as a whole. And that's, we hope, a pretty good comparison of what they're bringing to bear on climate change. And part of the reason to think that is that it's not really like you pay X dollars for a little bit of influence on one bill. You pay the lobbyists to develop the relationships over their whole career. So it's, lobbying is a long-term broad investment that sort of pays dividends on the issues that you sort of deploy on. So within that context, yeah, we came up with this ratio of 3.5-to-1 is we just took the 10 most engaged advocates or interest groups for and against climate legislation on, so looking at both sides, and then we just tallied up how much they spent on lobbying over the three legislative sessions that we studied. And yep, you're right. So we found a 3.5-to-1 ratio between the opposition and the advocates, between what they spent. But that actually makes it, the picture seem rosier than it is, because really the amount spent by the environmental advocates was skewed higher by one interest group, the Mass Municipal Association, that showed up on a raft of sort of particular bills more related to conservation and planning issues than clean energy. And if you just remove them and maybe remove their sort of equivalently ranked interest group on the opposition from the analysis, the ratio is more like 6-to-1, right? And so when you're looking at environmental groups like the Environmental League of Massachusetts, or really like Clean Water Action, who just don't have the resources to pay a professional, you know, career lobbyist from a top firm, then you compare them to someone who can hire a lobbyist from a firm that routinely retains ex state reps or even ex governors, there's a massive imbalance there. Yeah, and again, like, even with those numbers, it doesn't truly capture the difference in influence between a lobbyist who literally, like, was maybe friends with the speaker, or was, right, you know, the mentor of the current governor. That's a qualitative difference that we can't.
And just so this is, I'm learning something, because when you say money spent on lobbying, basically what we're talking about is the salary of the lobbyist, right? My mind rushes to sort of, you know, illicit payments and stuff, and we're spending millions, like the guys in Ohio, right? They spent $60 million to kill the nuclear plant. No, that's not what it is. We're saying that these are just bona fide, honest people that are taking a salary. But if you just go, you know, full-time equivalent, it's like there's 3.5 more people arguing against your bill than are arguing in favor of it, right? Even if all else is equal. And so there's a dramatic money leverage and extra weight on the side of the opponent. Interesting. Yeah. And there was one other point here. Let's see. On so this could consume the rest of our time together. Finding number 11, right? So let's touch on it now, because I'm afraid so the opponents, these professional people getting a full time salary, right? They love their children. They're honest people, right? They talk about climate change in specific ways. And I think from your report, you're saying they have developed new sorts of arguments against legislation that probably works pretty effectively in Massachusetts as opposed to some other part of the country. And the reason I want to get to it is because the people listening to the show who might be going in to testify, we'll probably bump into some of these things. I think, I mean, you've got, I'll say them for you, but there's policy perfectionism, which he says we only pass perfect laws. We don't do, there's this idea that the opponents of climate legislation can talk about social justice. They can say, oh, the fossil fuel industries are already doing all this great work, right? We're all done. And look how good Massachusetts already is, right? We don't, so tell me more about those kinds of arguments, since I've already put them out in front of us. I mean, which ones are the most effective, and where do they come from? And do you think that they work very well?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important thing to note. And the kind of the breakdown that we use in the report is actually developed from an international team of scholars who are seeing these arguments happening really all over the world. So the big shift really is right between before there's a lot of climate denialism, a big effort, right, to discredit the science. We saw almost pretty much none of that in Massachusetts. There was one piece of testimony in like the 1,000 that we looked at, right, that denied climate change. The rest was really of the opposition was these kinds of arguments, right, that say, okay, we do support climate action hypothetically, theoretically, but we don't support this particular policy for these reasons. Or in general, this isn't going to work out because of factors beyond our control. So in Massachusetts, I think one of the big ones, I think what we saw from the utilities is that they're very narrowly focused on the policy. So they say, okay, this policy is crafted this way. It's not going to work because it interferes with this other policy, or we actually need to study it more. And so we recommend that like the legislature looks at this further, and we need more time, so you should kill the bill. They want to be very neutral, right? They kind of know they're not particularly in the public eye in terms of climate, which is something we're hoping will change. But for right now, right, they're trying to kind of keep their distance. Fossil fuel industry, right, in comparison, is much more saying, we need fossil fuels. There's really no other option. There's these great quotes about this kind of doomsday scenario. If we move beyond fossil fuels, that the economy really collapse. Global poverty will rise, et cetera. Right. So there's these different arguments, but I think in general, on the whole, their aim is not to say that we shouldn't do anything on climate. Their aim is really to say, we know this is coming and we know this is going to hurt our bottom line this year. And so we'd much rather this happen in the future in a way that's more beneficial to us. Right. But they kind of know that distinction. And so they're willing to say, and they often do say, right, they support climate action. We believe in climate change science. But they shouldn't be applauded for that, right? Because their ultimate goal, in many of these cases, right, is to delay the actual policies right. that would get us somewhere.
I mean, I think it's important to point out that this kind of finding is, I mean, you guys are on target, because even with when Governor Baker vetoed the recent climate bill, one of his claims was that the improved building codes would make housing more expensive in the time of COVID. And that was just, and of course that was fed to him. Okay. I mean, I believe that was a line from the real estate industry, which is one of the people you guys have identified as resisting change. So you can, I mean, these things can sound that these arguments in the abstract can sound kind of distant, but they do translate, right? They really come in. I mean, I think the other one about, oh, Massachusetts is already a leader. Look how great we are, right? So we don't have to do anything anymore. That is the premature successism. And it's just, I mean, it's a useful frame to listen to the arguments from the other side, because it makes you much more of a hair trigger. I don't know, for me, I'm an old codger, right? You reject these stuff because you've heard it before. All right, so let's talk about. So there are some other interesting findings in here. One is that just generally speaking, it just so. I mean, one is that the power generators, the people who make the electricity, who have the gas-powered plant in, or want to build the biomass plant out in Springfield, they don't much like hydro and wind supply, right? They fight against those people. The renewable energy industries, that is to say the solar and wind people, like climate legislation, but they don't go to bat for it, right? They don't show up saying, oh, you must pass this climate bill. I mean, there's all these kind of subdivisions, even on the green side, right? I mean, is there a way around that? Or should that just be, you know, we let that stand and hope that we can find enough common ground that everyone pushes in the same direction once or twice?
So this is that's another really astute question. And I can speak for both of us that we feel like it's been sort of haunting us at different times. We've talked about this report, like what can we do with that information? How do we sort of act within the world that we've described here? So, you know, one sort of maybe cliche answer is that organized industry support is not a necessary condition for passing legislation. And so again, like just to emphasize, what we lay out here is a structure of obstacles, but they're not immovable even by, you know, just you and me working together and with other advocates and citizens. So on the other hand, it's sort of from the academic side of things, from the sort of political economy side of things, it's often only once an industry is established, so an industry like the wind, utility scale wind power or something like that, that it becomes easier for that industry to sort of, for lack of a better term, like extract rent out of the regulatory process or get what they want, right, out of the political process. What we describe is one extremely entrenched industry, the utilities, who have a natural regulated monopoly. And it's the details are complicated, right? But the utilities sort of own the structure on which everyone else is forced to operate. Every other energy industry is forced to operate. And then on the other hand, there are new entrants to the field, like small solar firms or new wind companies, like Ørsted, who just want to get a foothold in Massachusetts, at least, right? And so it's not surprising in that context to see that A, the old school fossil fuel power generators don't want them to establish that foothold, because then they're inviting a new opponent onto their turf, both economically, but also who they'll have to compete with politically, in that they'll have to like sway the allegiance of a regulator or legislator where they might not have had to before. But then it's also not surprising that those newcomers don't want to compete with the utilities yet, because they know that in a sort of fuzzy way, utilities have a blanket sort of influence over the legislature. But then we've also heard concerns that, like, well, what if they just don't hook us up to the electric grid, you know, honestly, people worry about that.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, we definitely don't want to say that we need to think about this as we are waiting for the massive utility scale wind people to get on our side and then things will move. But it is hopeful. There is some hope that things might move faster once there are established people in Massachusetts who show, you know, we have a big offshore wind industry now, right, 5 years from now or something, and who have a little more cachet with the legislators and the regulators to push for their interests too. Yeah.
Well, I hate to say it, but I think we need to cut off our conversation at this point. I mean, that we didn't get through all 12 of the findings, but dear listener, go check it out. They're worth reading. And you can find a link to the PDF of this report. The title again is "What's Delaying Climate?" Oh, I got it right here. "Who's Delaying Climate Action in Massachusetts? 12 Findings." All right,
yep.
By Galen Hall and Trevor Culhane. What we'll do is we'll put that on the MCAM blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have questions about the podcast or think you have an idea of something we ought to talk about, please send us an idea to the email podcast@massclimateaction.net. let us know what we should talk about. You can listen to our show on your smartphone using any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please rank us. Please ask your friends to rank us and listen to us. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. Thank you very much, D.R. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Galen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ted.
Trevor, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, it's good talking to you.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.